If there were only a few strong advisers to give your president's viewpoint. But those advisers who aren't Jewish are of British descent. It's a damnable situation. We'll beat the British, Captain Henry. We have the power. We never intended to fight them. The Fuhrer could have built 1,000 submarines and strangled England in 3 months. He never emphasized U-boats. You know that. What do we gain by such a victory? We only crush our finest natural ally.
Well, General, you attacked Poland when she was England's ally. You made the deal with Stalin. Those things are done.
They were forced on us.
Behind a gloved hand, Iago coughed long and genteelly.
We are a strange people, Captain Henry, hard for others to understand. We are very serious, very naive. Always we are reaching for the stars. To others we seem insensitive and arrogant. Our English cousins are every bit as arrogant, I assure you. Ah, but what a manner they cultivated! They despised their Jews. They keep them out of the clubs where power is concentrated, at the banks and all vital positions, but they act politely to them. We admitted the Jews to all our very highest circles until they swarmed in and threatened to take over entirely. But we showed our feelings. That's the difference. The German is all feeling, all Faustian striving. Appeal to his honor, and he will march, or fly, or sail to his death with a happy song. That is our naivete, yes, our primitivism. But it is a healthy thing. America, too, has its own naivete, the primitive realism of the frontier, the cowboys. What does it all add up to? We need friends in the United States to explain that there are two sides to this war, and that the only solution is peace in the West, unity in the West, an alliance in the West that can control the world. Ah, look there. The British marksmanship is rather hard on the French livestock, but that's about all.
On a distant hill, huge inverted pyramids of dirt splashed high in the air amid flame and smoke, and cows galloped clumsily around. The general glanced at his watch.
I have a little conference at headquarters. If you can stay for dinner, there is a very pleasant restaurant in Lille.
I have to return to Berlin, General. I can't express my gratitude, but... Up went the glove.
Please, to talk to an American, a professional military man, who shows some understanding of our situation, is literally good for my health.
Messerschmitts were landing in the rain when Iago turned Victor Henry over to his lieutenant at the entrance to the headquarters building.
If we can be of further service in the matter of Flight Lieutenant Gallard, let us know.
Iago said, stripping off a glove to offer a damp, cold hand.
Auf Wiedersehen, Captain Henry. If I have been of any small service, all I ask is this. Wherever duty takes you, remember, there are two sides to the war, and that on both sides there are men of honor.
The ornately molded and carved ceilings in Wolfstuhler's bank seemed 40 feet high. It was after hours. A few clerks worked silently behind the grills. The footsteps of the two men on the red marble floor echoed and re-echoed under the high vault, like the tramp of a platoon.
"It is a little gloomy here now," said Stuhler, "but very private. This way, Victor."
They passed through a sizable conference room into a small, richly furnished office, with a blaze of paintings crowding the walls. Little though he knew, Henry recognized two Picassos and a Renoir.
"So, you go so soon?"
Stirler said, gesturing to a heavy maroon leather couch.
"Did you expect us?"
"Well, I thought my relief would be along in a couple of weeks, but when I got back from Lille, here he was, waiting."
"Of course you are anxious to be reunited with your very beautiful wife,"
Victor Henry said, with a glance at the larger Picasso, a gruesomely distorted woman in flaring colors. "I thought modern art was frowned on in the Third Reich." Stirler smiled.
"It has not gone down in value. The Field Marshal has one of the great collections of the world. He was a very civilized man. He knows these things will change."
"They will?"
"Most assuredly, once the war is over. We are a nation under siege, Victor. Nerves get frayed, a mood of extremism prevails. That will die away. Europe will be a wonderful place to live. Germany will be the pleasantest place of all. What do you say to a glass of sherry?"
"That'll be fine, thanks." Stirler poured from a heavy crystal decanter.
"What do we drink to? I dare say you won't drink to the victory of Germany."
With a tart grin, Pug said, "We're neutral, you know."
"Ah, yes. Ah, Victor, if only you were. How gladly we would settle for that. Well, to an honorable peace."
"Sure, to an honorable peace." They drank.
"Possible?"
"Fine. I'm no expert on wines."
"It's supposed to be the best sherry in Europe."
"It's certainly very good." The banker settled in an armchair and lit a long cigar. In the light of the floor lamp, his scalp glistened pink through his thin, flat hair.
"Your little trip to Lille was a success, hm?"
"Yes, I'm obliged to you and the general."
"Please. By the ordinary rules, such a thing would not only be unusual, but utterly impossible. Among men of honor there are special rules."
Stirler heaved an audible sigh.
"Well, Victor, I didn't ask you to give me some time just to offer you sherry."
"I didn't suppose so."
"You're a military man. There are special conversations that sometimes have to be forgotten, obliterated without a trace. In German, we have a special phrase for these most delicate matters. Under four eyes."
"I've heard the phrase."
"What transpires next is under four eyes."
Victor Henry, intensely curious at this point, felt there was nothing to do but let the banker talk on. What might be coming next, he could not imagine. His best guess was a wispy peace feeler at second hand from Goering to convey to the president.
"You had a conversation with Gregor Jago about the course of the war, about the tragic absurdity of this fratricidal conflict between Germany and England."
Pug nodded.
"Did his ideas make sense to you?"
"Frankly, we don't study geopolitics in the Navy. At least we don't call it that. So I'm not up on Spengler and so forth."
"You're an American pragmatist," said Stirler with a smile.
"I'm a gunnery expert, misplaced in diplomacy, and hoping the hell to get out of it."
"I believe you. The man of honor wants to serve in the field."
"I'd like to do what I'm trained for."
"You do agree that American help, and expectation of far greater help, is what is keeping England in the war?"
"Partly. They just don't feel like quitting. They think they'll win."
"With American help?"
"Well, they think they'll get it."
"Then what stands between the whole Western world and an honorable peace, which you and I just drank to, is Churchill's reliance on help from Roosevelt?"
Pug took a few moments to answer. "Maybe, but what's an honorable peace? Churchill would want to depose Hitler. Hitler would want to depose Churchill. Both those gentlemen are equally firmly in the saddle, and both really represent the national will. So there you are. You are going back to serve as naval aide to President Roosevelt. Stirler said this with a slight interrogative note. Pug's face registered no surprise. I'm going back to the Bureau of Personnel for reassignment. The banker's smile was tolerant and assured.
Well, our intelligence usually gets these things right. Now, Victor, let me have my say, and don't break in until I've finished. That's all I ask, all right?
All right. The banker puffed twice at his cigar.
Men of honor talk among themselves, Victor, in a special language. I'm addressing you now in that vocabulary. These are matters of incredible delicacy. In the end, beneath the words there must be a spiritual kinship. With you, Gregor Iago and I have felt that kinship. You have been impeccably correct, but unlike so many people at the American Embassy, you don't regard Germans as cannibals. You have treated us as human beings, like yourself. So did your delightful and beautiful wife. It has been noticed, I assure you. That you sympathize with England is only natural. I do myself. I love England. I spent 2 years at Oxford. Now, you heard what Gregor said about the Jewish influence around your president. I know you have to deny it, but it is a very serious fact of this war. We must live with it and do what we can about it.
Pug tried to speak. Stirler held up a rigid palm.
You said you would hear me out, Victor?
In the circumstances, we need friends in Washington. Not to use undue influence, as the Jews do so shamelessly. Simply to present the other side. Roosevelt is a man of very broad vision. He can be made to see that American interest requires a swift, honorable peace in the West. For one thing, only such a development can free him to handle Japan. Do you suppose we give a damn about Japan? That new pact is all a comedy to keep the Russians worried and quiet. Now, Victor, and remember this is under four eyes, we do have such friends. Not many, a few. Patriotic Americans who see the realities of the war instead of the propaganda of the Jews, and of Churchill, who is just an adventurous megalomaniac and has never been anything else. We hope you'll be another such friend. Victor Henry regretted that he had drunk up the glass of sherry rather fast. The conversation was taking a turn which needed sharp handling. He leaned forward.
"Let me go on," said the banker, waving the cigar at him. "You know of my connection with Hermann Göring. To me he is a great figure of European history. His practical grasp of affairs and his energy still astound me. The Führer, well, the Führer is different. He operates on a plane above all of us, a plane of prophecy, of grand dreams. The engineer at the throttle is Göring. Nothing in Germany escapes him. Nothing happens that he does not approve and know about. You Americans, with your Puritan bias, think him a bit of a sultan. But we Germans love opera and opulence. It's a weakness. The field marshal knows that and plays to it. Of course, he certainly enjoys himself, too. Why not? His zest for life is Faustian, Rabelaisian. Victor, Hermann Göring has established in Switzerland some anonymous, untraceable bank accounts. His resources are enormous. These bank accounts, after the war, will be the rewards of Germany's honorable friends, who have said the right word in the right place for her when it mattered. It is nothing like espionage, where you pay some sneaking wretch for papers or information he hands over. This is simple gratitude among men of honor, a sharing of benefits in the day of victory. If our friends want the accounts, they will be there. If they don't...
Stirler shrugged and sat back.
I've said my piece, Victor. And after you've said yours, this conversation will be as if it never existed.
It was one of the few occasions in Victor Henry's life when he was taken totally by surprise.
That's interesting, he said. Extremely interesting.
After a measurable pause, he went on.
Well, first, please tell me, if you can, what made you, or General Iago, or Field Marshal Goering, think that I might be receptive to this approach? That's highly important to me, and to this whole matter, I assure you.
My dear chap, the Washington picture is vital, and you're en route to Washington. The day American supplies to England are shut off, we've won the war. We've got it won now, really, but England is just hanging on, hoping for... she doesn't know what. She'll be flat broke in 3 or 4 months, and if your Neutrality Act holds, that's the end. Now, Victor, the Field Marshal remembers your interesting visit with the banker Gianelli. His purpose now is exactly what Roosevelt's was then, to avoid further useless bloodshed. He thinks you can help, and General Iago is confident that you will.
Stirler gave Pug his most ingratiating smile, crinkling his eyes almost shut.
As for me, I know your exquisite wife is a very sympathetic and friendly woman. My guess is that she has always reflected your real feelings, more than your correct words. I trust I'm right.
Victor Henry nodded.
I see. That's a clear answer, Herr Stuller. Here's mine, under four eyes. Please tell Field Marshal Goering, for me, to stick his Swiss bank account up his fat ass.
Blue smoke wreathed around Stuller's shocked face. His eyes went wide and glassy. His face became dark red from his striped collar to his hair, and his scalp reddened too. His teeth showed in an ugly smile.
"I remind you, Captain Henry," he said in a new, slow, sing-song tone, "that you have not left the Third Reich yet. You are still in Berlin. Field Marshal Hermann Goering is second here only to the Führer."
"I'm an officer in the United States Navy. Unless I misunderstood you, or you want to withdraw it,"
Victor Henry's voice hardened almost to a bark,
"you've asked me, in his name, to commit treason for money."
The banker's nasty smile faded. In a placating tone, with a soft look, spreading out his hands, he said,
"My dear Victor, how can you take it that way? I beg you, think. The highest officers in the American armed forces blatantly and openly advocate help for England all the time. What I asked of you was just to present both sides, when the occasion arose, for the sake of American security and for peace."
"Yes, as a man of honor, I heard you. I really believe you meant it. General Iago said you Germans were a difficult people to understand. That is the truth. I'm giving up. My assignment here is over."
Victor Henry knew he had hit too hard, but he had reacted as he did in a ball game, on instinct and impulse. He stood, and the banker got to his feet too.
"See here, old top," Stirler said gently. "We Germans are at war, surrounded by foes. If the United States is ever in such a situation, and history takes strange turns, You may one day make an approach like this to a man you respect, and find it as difficult as I have. I think your response has been naive and wrong. Your phrasing was coarse. Still, the spiritual quality was there. It was an honorable reaction. I have absolutely no hard feelings. I trust you have none. I place a high value on your goodwill, Victor. And we did have good times at Abendru, didn't we?
Smiling, Stoller held out his smooth, thin, clean hand. Pug turned on his heel and walked out of the room. Out of the loudly echoing bank he walked, nodding at the door attendant's deep bow. In the warm, sunlit Berlin evening, on the sidewalk outside, beautiful German children surrounded a one-legged man on a crutch, who was selling pink paper dolls that danced on strings. Victor Henry walked several blocks at a pace that made his heart pound. The first new thought that came to him was that, with his grossly insulting words and acts, he might have murdered Ted Gallard.
Chapter 36 The Garden Hose, from World Empire Lost. The Falling Crown. The winter and spring between the Battle of Britain and our attack on the Soviet Union stand in popular history as a breathing spell. Actually, in these 8 months, the axis of the war changed, for the British Empire, as a reality, left the stage of history. In 1939, this momentous event lay shrouded in the future. A proper name for this war might well be the War of the British Succession. For the real question that was fought out was this. After the collapse of the British Empire, which would drag with it all European colonialism, what shape was the New World Order to take, and under whose rule? This historic turn and this momentous issue Adolf Hitler foresaw. He inspired and mobilized Germany to rise and dare all to seize the falling crown. The feats that our nation performed against odds will someday be justly treated in history, when passions die and the stain of certain minor excesses can be seen in perspective. Meantime, historians write as though only the struggles of the Allies were heroic, as though we Germans were a species of metal monster incapable of bleeding, freezing, or hungering, and therefore deserving of no credit for our vast victories. As Hitler said, the winning side writes the history. Yet, in their praise of their own arduous successes, the Allies, despite themselves, honor us. The nation that almost won the British succession against a combination of all the industrial nations in the world, except feeble Italy and far-off, impoverished Japan. For all of Hitler's military mistakes, and they were many and serious, my professional judgment remains that the German armed forces would have won the war and world empire but for one historical accident. His real opponent, produced by fate at this point in time, was an even craftier and more ruthless political genius, with more sober military judgment and greater material means for industrialized warfare. Franklin D. Roosevelt. The nation this man led was in no way comparable to the German people in military valor, as test after test in the field eventually showed. But that did not matter. This great manipulator so managed the war that other nations bled themselves almost to death so as to hand his country the rule of the earth on a silver platter. The United States of America, today the troubled master of the world, lost fewer men in the entire war than Germany expended in any one of half a dozen campaigns. Almost 20 million soldiers, sailors, and airmen perished in the Second World War. Of these, America, in 4 years of global war, lost about 300,000 on all fronts, including her war with Japan.
for this almost bloodless conquest of the earth, which has no parallel in all history, the American people can thank that enigmatic, still shrouded figure, the Augustus of the Industrial Age, the Dutch-descended millionaire cripple, Roosevelt. Franklin D. Roosevelt's world conquest still goes unrecognized. In the present historical writings on the war, he is granted nothing like the stature he will one day have. There is little doubt that he wanted it that way. The Augustan ruler, a recurring figure in history, seizes the realities of power under a mask of the humble, benign, humanitarian citizen. Nobody since the Emperor Augustus ever managed this as Franklin Roosevelt did. Even Augustus was not as sanctimonious, for in those days the Christian vocabulary of humility and humaneness was not in vogue to lend such depths to hypocrisy. Roosevelt's feat. In his successful waging of the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt made no major military mistakes. That is a record not matched by any world conqueror since Julius Caesar. His slogan of unconditional surrender was widely called a blunder by commentators as diverse as Goebbels and Eisenhower. I do not agree, and in its place I will take up that stricture and challenge it. Our propaganda office called him a tool of the Jews, but of course that was the silliest bosh. Roosevelt did nothing to save the Jews. He knew that any such action would annoy Congress and interfere with winning the war. Under his clever facade of a Christian humanitarian liberal, he was one of the coldest, most ruthless calculators in history. He sensed that the Americans liked the Jews no more than we did, and they amply confirmed this all through the war in their immigration policies, and at the Avion and Bermuda conferences, where they simply abandoned the Jews to their fate. This author is no admirer of Roosevelt as a person, but the aim of my work is to set down the facts as military history should view them. On such evaluation, Franklin Roosevelt was the mastermind of the war. Even such a powerful, energetic, and brilliant figure as Adolf Hitler was, in the end, no more than a foil for him. Adventuristic conquerors often pave the way in this fashion for the dominion of their enemies. The adventurer sees the opportunity and with meager means tries to capture it. He does the destroying and the bulldozing. His ice-blooded successor then crushes him and builds on the ruins. Napoleon, in the last analysis, merely put Wellington's England in the saddle for a century. Charles XII hardly has a place in history except as a foil for Peter the Great. And the German people, under Adolf Hitler, accomplished nothing in the long run except to hand the British succession to the United States under Roosevelt. Roosevelt's difficulty. Franklin Roosevelt's problem was that at this great turning point in history, he did not lead a warlike nation, whereas Adolf Hitler did. The American people are not cowardly, but living in prosperous isolation, they have been the spoiled children of modern history. Spoiled children do not bear well the rigors of the field. Once they entered the war, the Americans fought with a logistic train of luxury and self-protection that to the warriors of Germany, the Soviet Union, and even England, was laughable. Nevertheless, they had the riches and the will for this. The strong can fight any kind of fight they please. The Americans have a tradition of militia-like fighting. Presented with a threat, they drop their pleasures, take up arms, and fight amateurishly but bravely to get the thing over with. They formed this pattern in their revolution, and confirmed it in their Civil War and the First World War. Roosevelt understood this. He had to hold Germany at bay until he could present the chance for world conquest to his people in the guise of a threat to their safety. This, with a masterly exhibition of patient, spider-like waiting, he did. Meantime, he robbed Germany of two certain victories. over Great Britain, and over the Soviet Union, by an inspired instrument of indirect war-making, a genuine new thing in military history, the so-called Lend-Lease Act. A cunning trick. By the end of 1940, despite her narrow escapes at Dunkirk and in the air battle, Britain was sinking to her knees. She had only one recourse left on the planet to save her, the United States. But the Neutrality Act threatened to cut the English off from the American farms and factories that were keeping them alive. They were running out of dollars to pay even for grain and oil, let alone the ships, planes, guns, and bullets, which they could no longer manufacture for themselves in the necessary quantities, for they lacked labor, materials, and plant, and they kept falling further behind under air attack. The Neutrality Act forced belligerents to pay dollars for United States goods, and to come and fetch them. The act posed more of a dilemma for Roosevelt than for the British. For them, a clear, wise course lay open: negotiated peace with Germany. As this writer has often pointed out, had England made such a peace, the British Empire would exist today. The Soviet Union would have been crushed in a one-front war, and instead of rampant Bolshevism, we would see in Russia, at worst, some pacific, disarmed form of social democracy. But none of this fitted in with Roosevelt's ideas. He had no intention of allowing Germany to gain ascendancy over the Euro-Asian heartland in a world-dominating partnership with the Sea Lords of Britannia. And so, to circumvent the Neutrality Act, Franklin Roosevelt devised Lend-Lease, which was nothing more or less than a policy to give the British, free of charge, and later the Russians too, all the war materials they needed to fight us. The audacity of the trick was breathtaking. The disguise was cunning. And while the record shows that Roosevelt's clever advisers did much to push this unprecedented proposal through the stunned, balky Congress, it also clearly shows that the revolutionary idea sprang, in the phrase of Sherwood, straight from Roosevelt's forested mind. Roosevelt sold this scheme to the simple-minded, inattentive American people with a typical bit of Augustan demagoguery, the famous comparison to a garden hose. "When a neighbor's house is on fire," he said at a press conference, "one does not bargain with him over the sale or renting of the garden hose he needs to put it out. One gladly lends him the hose, so as to keep the fire from one's own house. Once the fire is out, the neighbor returns the hose, or, if he has damaged it, there is time enough then to settle the account." This was, of course, shameless and hollow poppycock. Warships, war planes, war materials are not garden hoses. To take Roosevelt's comparison at its face value, if your neighbor's house is on fire, what you really do is rush over there and fight the fire with him. You do not lend him your hose and then stand idly by watching him try to cope with the flames. That this silly stuff was swallowed whole by the Americans simply shows how uncannily shrewd Roosevelt was in managing them. During his successful 1940 election campaign for an unprecedented third term, he had declared in a famous speech, "I tell you again and again and again, your boys are not going to be sent into foreign wars." He was eagerly awaiting a chance to go back on this clear pledge. Meantime, he had to use tricks and guile to oppose Germany. The real meaning of Lend-Lease. It was impossible for him, and this he knew, to present the case to his people in realistic terms. Otherwise, he could have told them, in effect, "My friends, this war is for the mastery of the world. Our aim should be to achieve that mastery ourselves, but with a minimum of blood. Let us encourage others to do our fighting for us. Let us give them all the stuff they need to keep fighting. What do we care? In developing the industries to produce this lend-lease stuff, we will be preparing ourselves, industrially and militarily, for world leadership. They will use up all our early models, our discardable stuff, killing Germans for us. Maybe they will do the whole job for us, but that is doubtful. We will have to step in at the end, but mopping up will be easy. We will have gained a world victory with the expenditure of a lot of hardware, which we can turn out faster and in greater quantities than all the world put together, without even feeling the pinch. The others will shed the blood, and we will take the rule. That was what Lend-Lease meant, and that was how it worked. First, the British, and then the Russians, were induced by Lend-Lease to keep on with extremely bloody, almost hopeless struggles, when the easier, safer, more profitable alternative of negotiated peace always lay open to them. There is reason to think that at Stalin's low point, late in 1941, when his armies and his air force had virtually ceased to exist as coherent battle formations and we were smashing toward Moscow, that supreme realist would have proposed peace again, if not for the encouragement in words and supplies, not in lives, of the United States. As it was, the Russian people made sacrifices in blood never matched in all history to transfer world hegemony from one Anglo-Saxon power to another. And Franklin Roosevelt so maneuvered matters that the British had to beg for this bloodletting help. They were put in the position of being abjectly grateful for the chance to fight Roosevelt's battles. On December 8, 1940, Churchill wrote the American president a very long letter, which deserves a bolder place in history than it now holds. Churchill once said that he had not become prime minister to preside over the dissolution of the empire, but with this letter, he dissolved it. Churchill, in this document, frankly stated that England had come to the end of her rope in the matter of ships, planes, materials, and dollars. And he asked the president to find ways and means to help England in the common cause. This was what Roosevelt had been icily waiting for in his wheelchair, this written confession by the British Prime Minister that without American aid, the empire was finished. Within 2 weeks, he had proposed Lend-Lease to his advisers, and within a month, he had laid it before Congress. Empire means rule, and sufficient armed power to enforce the rule. In Churchill's letter, he acknowledged that his country and his empire had become powerless to enforce their rule and begged for succor. Roosevelt leaped to comply. Even if England was finished as an imperial power, she remained a country of 40 millions with a good navy and air force, at war with Roosevelt's arch-rival. A splendid island base, just off the coast of Europe, moreover, from which to attack Germany in the future. The first order of business was to keep her fighting. Bargain war-making. Despite all the quack language in the act about lending and leasing, the transfer of American weapons and materials throughout the war was a gift. No formal accounting was even kept. The president asked, and the Congress granted him, power to send arms and war goods wherever he pleased, in whatever quantities he pleased. Certainly the Congress, when they passed the law, would have balked at including Bolshevist countries, but at that time the Soviet Union was supposedly Hitler's friend. Later, when war broke out on the Eastern Front, Roosevelt poured a flood of supplies to the Bolsheviks without consulting Congress. The Americans complain that the Russians have never shown proper gratitude. The attitude of the Russians is more realistic. Having spilled the blood of perhaps 11 million of their sons to help the United States to its present world position, they tend to feel that the tanks and planes were paid for. The Yankees love a bargain. Lend-Lease was bargain war-making. For the big corporations, and for millions of workers, it merely meant a tremendous increase of prosperity. The price was painlessly postponed to the future by means of defense bonds. Others did the actual fighting and dying. Roosevelt and his advisors did discuss the risk that Germany would take Lend-Lease as an act of war, which it certainly was, and would formally declare war on the United States. Since this was just what he wanted, he was prepared to run the risk. America would have responded with a militia-like surge. Little as Adolf Hitler understood the United States, he did understand that. He had no intention of taking on the United States until he had finished with the Soviet Union, an operation which was already in an advanced planning stage. So Germany swallowed Lend-Lease with some harsh words, and the arsenal of democracy tooled up to help British plutocracy and Russian Bolshevism destroy the Reich, the last bastion in Europe against the Red Slav tide. Translator's Note. Most broad statistics of the war are approximations, and the figures on total deaths vary widely from one source to another. The low rate of eventual American losses is a fact. We planned and fought that kind of war, expending money and machines instead of human lives where possible. Roon seems to think this indicates a deficiency in American valor. We had enough valor to beat the Germans wherever we took them on. That was all the valor we needed. V.H. Chapter 37. Traveling to his new post in mid-January, Leslie Sloat found himself stalled in Lisbon by a shortage of Lufthansa accommodations to Berlin. He checked into the Palace Hotel in Estoril, Lisbon's palm-lined seaside resort, where diplomats, wealthy refugees, Gestapo, and other foreign agents congregated. He thought he might pick up some information there while he waited for an air reservation to open up. Actually, he found Estoril in January an exceedingly chilly and boring place. The Germans abounded, but they kept in aloof clusters, regarding other people with supercilious eyes. He sat in the crowded lobby of the hotel one afternoon, gnawing at his pipe and reading in a Swiss newspaper about British successes against the Italians in Abyssinia and North Africa. Faint rays in the gloom. The neutral newspaper had been hard to come by. Fascist and Nazi journals now blanketed Portuguese newsstands, with a few scrawny, disgustingly servile periodicals from Vichy France. British and American publications had vanished. It was a fair barometric reading of the way the war was going, at least in the judgment of Portugal's rulers. A year ago, on Lisbon newsstands, papers of both sides had been equally available. "Mr. Sloat! Mr. Leslie Sloat!" He jumped up and followed the small pink-cheeked page to a telephone near the reception desk. "Leslie, hello, it's Bunky. How goes it by the old seaside?" Bunker Wendell Thurston, Jr. had attended the Foreign Service School with Sloat and now held the post of Second Secretary in the American Legation in Lisbon. "Mighty dull, Bunky. What's up?"
"Oh, nothing much." Thurston sounded amused. "It's just that you've spoken to me now and then, I believe, about a girl named Natalie Jastrow."
Sloat said sharply.
"Yes, I have. What about her?"
"A girl by that name is sitting across the desk from me."
"Who is? Natalie?"
"Like to talk to her? When I told her you were here, she jumped a foot."
"Christ, yes!"
Natalie came on the phone laughing, and Sloat's heart throbbed at the familiar, lovely sound.
"Hello, old Sloat," she said. "Natalie, this is so staggering and wonderful. What are you doing here?"
"Well, how about you?" Natalie said. "I'm as surprised as you are. Why aren't you in Moscow?"
I got hung up, in Washington and then here. Is Aaron with you?
I wish he were. He's in Siena.
What? Aren't you on your way back to the States?
Natalie took a moment to answer.
Yes and no. Leslie, as long as you're here, can I see you for a while?
Naturally. Wonderful. Immediately. I'll come into the legation.
Wait, wait. You're at the Palace Hotel, aren't you? I'll come out and meet you. I'd rather do that.
Bunky Thurston came on the line.
Look, Leslie, I'll put her on the bus. She'll arrive in half an hour or so. If I may, I'll join you two in the palace lobby at 5.
She still had a fondness for big, dark hats. He could see her through the dusty bus window, moving down the aisle in a jam of descending passengers. She ran to him, threw her arms around him, and kissed his cheek.
"Hi. I'm freezing. I could have worn my ratty beaver coat, but who'd think it would be this cold and gray in Lisbon? It's even colder out here by the sea, isn't it?"
She clapped her hand to her hat as the wind flapped it.
"Let's look at you. Well, no change. If anything, you look rested."
She said all this very fast, her eyes wide and shiny, her manner peculiarly excited. The old spell worked at once. In the months since he had last seen Natalie, Sloat had started up a romance with a girl from Kansas named Nora Jameson. Nora was tall, brunette, and dark-eyed, like this one, but otherwise as different as a doe from a bobcat. Even-tempered, affectionate, bright enough to be in her third year as a senator's secretary, and pretty enough to play leads with a semi-professional Washington theater group. Her father was a rich farmer. She drove a Buick convertible. She was altogether a find, and Sloat was thinking seriously of marrying her on his return from Moscow. Nora worshipped him, and she was better looking than Natalie Jastrow and much easier to manage. But this Jewish girl in the big hat put her arm around him and brushed his face with her lips. He experienced a stabbing remembrance of what her love was like, and the snare closed on him again. He said, "Well, you know how I admire you, but you do look slightly beat up."
"Do I ever? I've had hell's own time getting here. Let's get out of this wind. Where's the Palace Hotel? I've been to Estoril twice, but I forget."
He said, taking her arm and starting to walk, "It isn't far. What's the story? Why didn't Aaron come? What are you doing here?"
"Byron's arriving tomorrow on a submarine."
He halted in astonishment. She looked up at him, hugged his arm, and laughed, her face alive with joy.
"That's it. That's why I'm here."
"He made it through that school?"
"You sound surprised."
"I thought he might find it too much work."
"He squeaked by. This is his first long cruise, the subs stopping here just for a few days. I suppose you think I'm rattle-brained, but he wrote me to come and meet him, and here I am."
"Nothing you do really surprises me, sweetie. I'm the man you came to visit in Warsaw in August 39. Again she squeezed his arm, laughing.
"So I did. Quite an excursion that turned out to be, hey? My God, it's cold here. It's a wonder all these palm trees don't turn brown and die. You know, I've been through Lisbon twice before, Sloat, and each time I've been utterly miserable. It feels very strange to be happy here."
He asked her about Aaron Jastrow's situation. Natalie said the impact of the note from the Secretary of State's office had somehow been frittered away. The fact that Jastrow's lapsed passport showed a questionable naturalization had fogged his case. Van Winneker, the young consul in Florence, had dawdled for almost a month, promising action and never getting around to it. Then he had fallen ill and gone for a cure in France, and several more weeks had slipped by. Now Van Winneker was corresponding with the department on how to deal with the matter. She had his firm promise that one way or another he would work it out. The worst of it was, she declared, that Aaron himself really was in no hurry to leave his villa, now that it seemed just a matter of unraveling a little more red tape. He half-welcomed every new delay, though he went through the motions of being vexed. This was what was defeating her. He would not fight, would not put any pressure on the consul to settle the thing. He was writing serenely away at his Constantine book, keeping to all his little routines and rituals, drinking coffee in the lemon house, taking his walks at sunset, rising before dawn to sit blanketed on the terrace and watch the sun come up. He believed that the Battle of Britain had decided the war, that Hitler had made his bid and failed, and that a negotiated peace would soon emerge. "I suppose I made a mistake, after all, going back to Italy," she said, as they walked into the hotel. "With me around, he's perfectly comfortable and not inclined to budge." Sloat said, "I think you were right to return. He's in more danger than he realizes, and needs a hard push. Maybe you and I, together, can shake him free." "But you're going to Moscow." "I have 30 days, and I've only used up 10. Perhaps I'll go back to Rome with you. I know several people in that embassy."
"That would be marvelous."
Natalie halted in the middle of the pillared lobby.
"Where's the bar?"
"It's down at that end, and it's very dismal and beery. It's virtually Gestapo headquarters."
"Why?
Would you like a drink?"
"I'd just as lief have tea, Leslie."
Her manner was oddly evasive.
"I haven't eaten all day. I was just wondering where the bar was."
He took her to a long, narrow public room full of people in sofas and armchairs, drinking tea or cocktails. Walking down the smoky room behind the headwaiter, they heard conversations in many languages. German was the commonest, and only one little group was talking English.
"League of Nations here,"
Natalie said, as the waiter bowed them into a dark corner with a sofa and two chairs.
"Except that so many look Jewish."
"A lot of them are," Sloat said dolefully. "Too many of them are." Natalie devoured a whole plate of sugared cakes with her tea.
"I shouldn't do this, but I'm famished. I'm big as a house. I've gained 10 pounds in 6 months at the villa. I just eat and eat."
"Possibly I'm prejudiced, but I think you look like the goddess of love, if a bit travel-worn."
"Yes, you mean these hefty Venus de Milo hips, eh?"
She darted a pleased look at him.
"I hope Byron likes hips. I've sure got 'em."
"I hadn't noticed your hips, but I assure you Byron will like them. Not that I really think you're worried. There's Bunky Thurston."
Sloat waved as a little man at the doorway far down the room came toward them.
"Bunky's a prince of a fellow."
"He has the world's most impressive mustache," Natalie said.
"It's quite a mustache," Sloat said.
The mustache approached, a heavy, rounded, tawny brush with every hair gleamingly in place, attached to a pleasant pink moon face set on a slight body, dressed in natty gray flannel.
Sloat said, "Hi, Bunky. You're late for tea, but just in time for a drink."
With a loud sigh, Thurston sat.
"Thanks. I'll have a double Canadian club and water. What foul weather. The chill gets in your bones. Natalie, here's that list I promised you."
He handed her a folded mimeographed sheet.
"I'm afraid you'll agree that it kills the notion. Now, I couldn't track down Commander Bathurst, but I left word everywhere. I'm sure he'll call me here within the hour."
Sloat glanced inquisitively at the paper in Natalie's hand. It was a list of documents required for a marriage of foreigners in Portugal, and there were 9 items. Avidly studying the sheet, Natalie drooped her shoulders and glanced from Sloat to Thurston.
"Why, getting all this stuff together would take months."
"I've seen it done in 1 month," Thurston said, "but 6 to 8 weeks is more usual. The Portuguese government doesn't especially want foreigners to get married here. I'm not sure why. In peacetime, we send people over to Gibraltar, where you go through like greased lightning. But the rock is shut up tight now."
thinking of getting married? Sloat said to Natalie. She colored at the dry tone. That was one of the many things Byron wrote about. I thought I might as well check. It's obviously impossible. Not that I thought it was such a hot idea anyway.
Who's Commander Bathurst? Sloat said.
Thurston said, Our naval attaché. He'll know exactly when the submarine's arriving. He tossed off half his whiskey when the waiter set it before him and carefully smoothed down his mustache with two forefingers, looking around the room with a bitter expression.
God, Lisbon gives me the creeps. 40,000 desperate people trying to get out of the net. I've seen most of the faces in this room at our legation.
Thurston turned to Sloat.
This isn't what you and I bargained for when we went to foreign service school.
Bunky, you'd better get rid of that Quaker conscience, or you really will crack up. Remember that it isn't us who's doing it, it's the Germans.
Not entirely. I never thought much about our immigration laws until this thing started. They're pernicious and idiotic.
Bunky Thurston drank again and coughed, empurpling his face.
40,000 people. 40,000! Suppose we admitted them all. What difference would 40,000 people make, for God's sake, in the wastes of Montana or North Dakota? They'd be a blessing.
They wouldn't go there. They'd huddle in the big cities where there's still an unemployment problem. Thurston struck the table with a fist.
Now don't you give me that stale drivel, Leslie. It's enough that I have to parrot it all day myself. They'd go anywhere, you know that. They'd sign papers to live out their lives in Death Valley. Our law's inhuman. Wasn't America started as a sanctuary from European oppression?
Sloat took off his glasses, rubbed his eyes, and glanced warily at the people nearest them. Four elderly men arguing in French.
Well, I'm not going to defend the law, but how do you draw the line? Or do you have unrestricted immigration? Do you let in everybody who wants to come? You'd empty Southern and Eastern Europe. They'd flood our economy, starve, ferment, and boil up in a revolution. What about the Orientals? Do you break the dike to the West? In 10 years, the United States would be a big Chinese suburb.
Natalie said with a gesture at the room, He's talking about these few people in Lisbon who have escaped from the Germans, that's all.
Tried to escape, said Thurston. The Germans can take Portugal overnight.
And I'm talking about the arguments that arise in Congress when you try to alter the law, Sloat said, and especially in favor of Jews. Nobody wants any more competition from them. They're too energetic and smart.
That's the fact of it, Natalie, like it or not. We could give refuge to all the Jews in Europe, all 5 million of them. We'd only be a lot better off, Thurston said. Remember your Ruskin. Wealth is life, he said, and if that's a bit too simple, it's certainly true that wealth is brains.
He leaned toward Natalie, lowering his voice.
If you want to see the head of the Gestapo in Portugal, he's just walking in, and with him is the German ambassador. Charming man, the ambassador. My wife really likes him.
Natalie stared. Is he the one with the scar?
No, I don't know who that one is, though I've seen him around. I'm sure he's Gestapo, too. The ambassador's the one in the gray suit.
The three men sat not far from them, and the head waiter fluttered and grinned eagerly, taking their orders.
They look so ordinary, Natalie said.
The Germans are quite ordinary, Sloat said. It's a little scary, in fact, how much like Americans they are.
Gloomily, Natalie said, Those people at the table next to them are obviously Jews, drinking and laughing. Side by side with the Gestapo. Eerie.
Thurston said, I know them. They bought their way out of Belgium, and they still don't believe they can't buy their way into the United States.
Most of the Jews here have been stripped penniless, but there are a handful of those. They're in the casino night after night, whooping it up. Fish in the net, jumping and flopping, still enjoying the water while they can.
Thurston finished his drink, smoothed his mustache, and waved his glass at the waiter.
I want another. I've had some awful interviews today. Lisbon is a very sad and horrible place right now. My request for a transfer is in. The question is whether I'll wait. I may just quit the service. I've never realized before how nice it is to have a wealthy father.
Sloat said to Natalie, Am I taking you to dinner?
Please, I'd love that.
How about you, Bunky? Will you join us? Let's all go upstairs to my suite for a while. I want to change my shirt and all that.
No, I have a dinner appointment. I'll sit here and have my drink with Natalie. I left word for Bathurst to page me here.
Sloat stood up.
Well, thanks for all you've done. I can do wonders for people who don't need help.
Sloat told Natalie the number of his suite and left. Later, she found a penciled note stuck in his door jamb. N. Doors open. She walked into a very large living room, looking out onto the purple sea beyond a long, iron-railed balcony. Old, heavy gilt and green furniture, gold cloth draperies, gilded mirrors, and large, dark old paintings filled the room. Sloat sang in a remote, gushing shower. She yelled through an open bedroom door,
Hey, I'm here!
The water shut off, and he soon appeared in a plaid robe, toweling his head.
How about these digs? Fit for a Rajah, what?
The legation had it reserved for some petroleum big shot, and he didn't show.
I've got it for a week.
It's fine.
She dropped heavily in a chair.
What's the matter?
Bathurst finally called. Briney's sub has been rerouted to Gibraltar. It won't come to Lisbon at all. No explanation, that's just how it is.
I see. Well, too bad. Maybe you can get to see him at Gibraltar.
Thurston doesn't think so, but he's going to the British Embassy tomorrow morning, first thing to find out. He's being very kind, especially since it's obvious he thinks I'm a damned fool. No doubt you do, too.
She looked up at him with a defiant scowl that was familiar and beguiling, took off her hat, and tossed her hair.
What had you told him about Briney, anyway, and about me? He seemed to know quite a bit.
Oh, we had too much wine one night, and I cried on his shoulder about my tragic love life. I was very nice about Byron, I assure you, considering.
She said with a trace of malice,
Yes, I'll bet.
Say, this is quite a layout at that. It'll bankrupt you.
Not in the few days I'll be here.
Me, I've dropped my bags in a flea trap back in town, sharing a room with a poor old Jewish lady from Rotterdam whose husband got pulled off the train in Paris.
I haven't had a shower since Sunday.
Look, why not move in here? There's an extra room for a maid. I'll sleep in there. Look at that bed. A football field. It's yours.
Nothing doing.
Listen, Sloat, if I can get to Gibraltar, I'll marry Byron. That's what he wants.
Sloat, combing his hair at a mirror framed by trumpeting gilded cherubs, stopped and gave her a pained, skeptical look. She went on nervously.
I know it sounds harum-scarum and wild.
Her eyes suddenly shone, and she laughed.
But in point of fact, I want to do it myself.
Well, I suppose I should congratulate you, Natalie. God knows I wish you well.
Oh, I know you do, Sloat. Don't bother telling me how bizarre all this is. Some things are just inevitable. I love Byron.
Well, the place is at your disposal, anyway. They eat dinner late here. Take a shower.
And climb into the same old underwear?
Natalie shook her head, looking thoughtful.
I noticed a shop downstairs. Let me see what Lisbon can offer a big heifer like me. She came back shortly, carrying a box and looking sly. Did you mean that invitation? I bought a pile of stuff. Maybe it's my trousseau. A fast half hour of shopping. They had all these things from Seville, cheap and just yummy. Byron's eyes will pop out of his head if he ever shows up.
Are you low on money now?
My dear, I'm still rolling in it. That's one thing about sitting on that Siena hill with nothing to spend it on. Aaron pays me like clockwork, and it just accumulates. Really, may I stay? I hate the idea of going back to town tonight. That poor old woman gives me the horrors.
I said the place is yours.
I can't register. Don't worry. All right. She paused at the bedroom door and turned, holding the box in both arms. Her intense, dark glance shook the diplomat. People wouldn't understand about us, would they, Sloat?
There's nothing to understand about me. You're the puzzle.
You didn't used to think I was puzzling. I thought I had you figured out. I'm paying a steep price for oversimplifying. You were an egotistical fool. I am very fond of you.
Thanks, Jastrow. Go take your goddamn shower.
Next morning, a buzzing at the suite door woke Sloat. Tying on a robe, he came yawning out of the tiny maid's room and blinked. There, in a blaze of sunshine, sat Natalie in a dazzling white wool dress with a broad red gold-buckled belt, watching a waiter fuss over a breakfast on a wheeled table.
"Oh, hi," she said, smiling brightly and touching her carefully coiffed hair. "I didn't know whether you wanted to get up. I ordered eggs for you just in case. Everything's so cheap and plentiful here."
"I'll brush my teeth and join you. You're all spiffed up. How long have you been awake?"
"Hours and hours. I'm supposed to wait for Byron in the bar here at 11 o'clock today. That was the original plan."
Sloat rubbed his eyes and peered at her.
"What's the matter with you? His sub's en route to Gibraltar."
"That's what that man Bathurst said. Suppose he's mistaken."
"Natalie, he's the naval attaché."
"I know that."
Shaking his head, Sloat signed for the breakfast and left the room. Soon he returned in a shirt, slacks, and sandals, and found her eating with appetite. She grinned at him.
"Forgive me for being a pig, dear. What a difference sunlight makes. And coffee. I feel marvelous."
He sat down and cut into a ripe Spanish melon. "Sweetie, do you honestly expect Byron Henry to materialize in the bar of this hotel at 11 o'clock? Just on your sheer willpower?"
"Well, Navy signals get crossed up like any others, don't they? I'm going to be there."
"It's just irrational, but suit yourself."
"Do you like my dress? I bought it yesterday right out of the window of that shop."
"Very becoming."
She kept glancing at her watch.
"Well, wish me luck," she said at last, dropping her napkin on the table. "I'm off."
"Do you intend to sit in the bar all day, like patience on a monument?"
"Don't be cross with me, Leslie."
"I'm not. I'd just like to plan the time."
"Well, obviously, if he hasn't shown by noon or thereabouts, the next thing is to find out how I get to Gibraltar."
"I'll call Bunky on that, and I'll come down at noon."
"Will you please? Thanks, Leslie. Thanks for everything."
"That bed's wonderful. I haven't slept so well in months."
She could not quite keep the mischief out of her face as she said this, and left with a nonchalant wave. Clearly, thought Sloat, she was relishing his discomfiture. The tables were turned, and he had to endure it until he could turn them again. He judged his chance was now at hand. Leslie Sloat intended to take every possible advantage of this encounter. He could not understand Natalie's resolve to squander herself on Byron Henry.
He had made a fearful mistake in his early treatment of this magnificent girl, and now he wanted to retrieve it. Sloat knew how a divorced man must feel, finding himself thrown together with an ex-wife he still loved. Between them stood a barrier of old quarrels and new properties. It had effectively kept him out of the big bed last night. But beneath all that lay a deep bond. If it had not been for Natalie's fortuitous passion for the strange, skinny Henry kid, he believed, they would by now be back together, very likely married. And he honestly thought he was more worthy of her and better suited to her. Natalie might thrash about here in Lisbon for a while, he calculated. Her willpower was formidable, but Gibraltar was probably impossible to get to. She would have to go back to Italy. He would accompany her to Siena, pry Aaron Jastrow loose, and send them both home. If necessary, he would wire Washington for a travel time extension. If he could not win Natalie back during all this, he sadly overestimated himself and the tie between them. He had been her first lover, after all. Sloat believed that no woman ever really forgot the first man who had had her, ever got him quite out of her system. He finished his breakfast at leisure, then telephoned Thurston. "Morning, Bunky. What did you find out about Natalie's going to Gibraltar?" "Forget it, Les. That submarine's here." Sloat had seldom heard worse news, but he suppressed any emotion in his voice. "It is. How come?" "I don't know. It came in at dawn. It's tied up down at the river, near the custom house."
"Then what on earth was Bathurst talking about?"
"He's mighty puzzled, and he's going down there later to talk to the skipper. That submarine had orders to go to Gibraltar."
"How long will it be here?"
"The original schedule called for 3 days." Thurston's voice turned puckish. "Tough luck, Les. Fantastic girl. I'd sweat out the 3 days and then see."
In self-defense, Sloat said calmly,
"Yes, she's all right, but she used to be a lot prettier."
He dressed and hurried downstairs. In the dark bar, there were only a handful of Germans who turned suspicious faces to him. He went striding through the lobby.
"Here, Sloat, look behind you."
Natalie's voice rang like joyous bells. Half-screened by potted palms, she sat on a green plush sofa with Byron. Before them, on a coffee table, beside an open dispatch case, lay a pile of documents. The girl's cheeks flamed, her eyes were gleaming, her whole face brilliantly animated. Byron Henry jumped up to shake hands. He appeared just the same, even to the tweed jacket in which Sloat had seen him for the first time, slouched against a wall in Siena. Sloat said,
"Well, hello there. Did Natalie tell you we had some very wrong information?"
Byron laughed.
"It wasn't wrong exactly, but anyway, here we are."
His glance swept the lobby.
"Say, this place has a queer smell of Berlin. Isn't it full of Germans?"
"They swarm, darling. Don't say anything about anything." Excitedly shuffling the documents, Natalie pulled at Byron's hand.
"I can't find your certificate of residence."
"It's clipped with yours."
"Then he's got everything," Natalie exclaimed to Sloat. "Everything. All by the regulations, translated into Portuguese, notarized, and the notary seals authenticated by Portuguese consuls. The works!"
As Byron dropped beside her, she put her hand in his thick hair and gave his head a yank.
"I thought you were lousy at paperwork, you devil. How in God's name did you manage this?"
Sloat said, "Are you really sure everything's there? I've never seen regulations as tough as these. Suppose I check that stuff over for you."
"Oh, please, Leslie, would you?"
Natalie said, making room on the sofa and handing him the documents and the sheet Thurston had given her. Red ink check marks ran down the side of the page.
"How do you assemble all this?" Sloat said, starting to examine the papers. Byron explained that as soon as he had learned of the scheduled cruise to Lisbon, he had obtained an emergency 4-day pass and had flown to Washington to find out at the Portuguese embassy what the marriage regulations were. The naval attaché there, Captain Desagoy, had turned out to be a friend of his from Berlin. The captain had been his tennis doubles partner for a while, playing against his father and the Swedish attaché. Desagoy had gone right to work.
"It's surprising what those fellows can accomplish in a few days when they want to," Byron said. "I rounded up some of the papers, but the Portuguese consuls themselves did the hardest ones."
"That's the foreign service everywhere," said Sloat, methodically turning over one paper after another and glancing at the checklist. "The wheels either turn glacially or go so fast you can't see them whiz. Well, Byron, I honestly think you, or this Portuguese Navy captain, or both of you, did it. Everything seems to be here."
"What now?" Natalie said. "Will you marry me?" Byron said very solemnly. Natalie said, "I sure will, by God."
They burst out laughing. With a melancholy chuckle, Sloat slipped the papers into the folder, which Byron had labeled in neat red block letters, "Marriage."
"Suppose I telephone Thurston and ask him what you do next. Thurston's my friend here in the legation, Byron."
Byron Henry slowly, gratefully smiled, and Sloat could not but see how appealing the smile was.
"Thanks a lot, will you? I'm not thinking too clearly at the moment."
"No, on the whole, I'd say you're doing all right."
Returning a few minutes later, he saw them holding hands on the sofa, looking adoringly at each other and both talking at once. He hesitated, then approached them.
"Sorry, problems."
Natalie looked up at him, startled and frowning.
"What now?"
"Well, Bunky's bowled over by what you've done, Byron. Just impressed as hell. He's at your service and wants to help. But he doesn't know what he can do about that 12-day requirement for posting bans. Then there's the Foreign Office's authentication of the consul's signatures. He says that usually takes a week. So..."
Sloat shrugged and dropped the folder on the table.
"Right. Desagoy mentioned both those points," Byron said. "He thought they could be gotten around. I stopped off at the Navy Ministry on the way here this morning and gave his uncle a letter. His uncle's a commodore or something. He was awfully nice to me, but he only speaks Portuguese. I think he's working on those snags. I'm supposed to go back to the ministry at 1 o'clock. Could Mr. Thurston meet us there? That might be a real help."
Sloat looked from Byron to Natalie, whose mouth was twitching with amusement. She still held Byron's hand in her lap.
"I'll call back and ask him. You've certainly been forehanded."
"Well, I sort of wanted this to come off."
With some stupefaction, Bunker Thurston agreed over the telephone to meet them at the Navy building at 1.
"Say, Leslie, I thought you called this ensign of hers a sluggard and a featherhead. He's organized this thing like a blitzkrieg."
"Surprised me."
"You have my sympathies."
"Oh, shut up, Bunky. I'll see you at 1.
"You're coming, too?"
"Yes, oh yes."
"You're a glutton for punishment."
A tall man in navy dress blues leaned on the fender of an automobile outside the hotel, smoking a very black, very fat cigar.
"Hey, Briney, is the exercise on?"
"It's on."
Byron introduced him to Natalie and Sloat as Lieutenant Astor, his executive officer. Astor took in the girl with a keen, rather greedy glance of pale, small blue eyes. He was broader and heavier than Byron, with thick, wavy blonde hair growing to a peak on his forehead, and a long face that looked genial because the corners of his mouth turned up. But it was a tight, tough mouth.
"Say, Natalie, that picture of you that Briney keeps mooning over doesn't do you justice. Hop in, everybody. I phoned the skipper, Briney, and told him you'd made contact. You're off the watch list while we're here."
"Great, lady, thanks."
Not sure she had heard this right, Natalie said, "Lady?" The executive officer's smile was a bit weary.
"That happened to me in my plebe year at the academy. With a name like Astor, I guess it had to. My name's Carter, Natalie, and by all means use it."
Driving into the city, the two submariners described how the S-45, 150 miles out of Lisbon, had in fact been ordered to Gibraltar. The captain, who knew about Byron's plans, had expressed his regrets but altered course to the south. Within an hour, reports came in to the captain that the number two main engine was down, the forward battery was throwing off excessive hydrogen, an evaporator had salted up, and a general plague of malfunctions was breaking out in the old boat, necessitating an emergency call in Lisbon for 2 or 3 days of alongside repairs. Astor, who brought in the reports, gave his opinion, which was backed by the chief of the boat, that it might be hazardous to proceed to Gibraltar. All this was done with a straight face, and with a straight face the captain accepted the executive officer's recommendation and turned back to Lisbon.
"How can you possibly get away with that?" said Sloat. "Won't you all be court-martialed?"
"Nobody was lying," Astor said with an innocent smile. "We have the engine records to prove it. These old S-boats just gasp and flounder along, and at practically any moment you could justify an order to abandon ship. Coming into Lisbon was highly commendable prudence."
Natalie said to Byron,
"And you submerge in an old wreck like that?"
"Well, the S-45 has made 4,723 dives, Natalie. It should be good for a few more."
"Diving is nothing," said Lady Astor. "You pull the plug and she goes down. You blow air and she pops up. It's going from one place to another that's kind of a strain on the old hulk. But we manage. By the way, everybody's invited aboard after the ceremony."
"Me? On a submarine?"
Natalie tucked her skirt close around her thighs.
"The captain wants to congratulate you. He was pretty nice about coming into Lisbon, you know."
"We'll see," Natalie said. "Sloat, are you trying to maim us all?"
"Sorry, that truck came out of nowhere," said Sloat, pulling the car back on the bumpy road. He was driving too fast. Shaking hands in the sunshine outside the Navy Ministry, Bunker Thurston gave Ensign Henry a prolonged, curious scrutiny.
"I'm glad to meet a fellow with such a knack for getting things done."
"This thing's not done yet, by a long shot, sir. Thanks for offering to help out."
"Well, come along and let's see what happens. You've got some strong pull on your side. Desaguy seems to be something like a deputy chief of naval operations."
Judging by the number of anterooms and armed guards outside his office, the size of the room, the magnificence of the furniture, and the effulgence of his gold braid and combat ribbons, Desaguy certainly held some exalted post. He was a short, dark man, with an elongated stern Latin face and heavy hair graying at the sides. He held himself, and shook hands, and gestured, as he welcomed them, with noble grace. And to Natalie he made a deep bow, his black eyes showing a spark of admiration. He turned businesslike and rattled rapidly to Thurston in Portuguese.
"He says these things take time," Thurston reported. "He would like to invite us all to lunch."
Byron glanced at Natalie and said, "That's very cordial of him. Does he know we only have 3 days?"
"I'm not sure you ought to press him," Thurston muttered.
"Please, tell him what I said."
"Okay."
The Portuguese officer listened gravely to Thurston. His eyes were on Byron. A wrinkle of his mouth, a flash of fun in the somber face, acknowledged the impatience of a young lover. He turned and rapped an order to an assistant, only slightly less crusted with gold braid than himself, who sat at a small desk. The assistant jumped up and went out.
After a minute of heavy silence, he returned with a bouquet of red roses. He gave these to Desogoy, who handed them to Natalie Jastrow, with a bow and a few charmingly spoken words. Thurston translated. "The dew will not dry on these roses before you are married."
"Good God, how beautiful! Thank you!"
Natalie's voice trembled. She stood, holding the roses, looking around at the men, blushing.
"You know, I'm beginning to believe it, for the very first time."
"The exercise is on, lady," said Lieutenant Astor. "Cancel now, if you're ever going to."
"Cancel?" She took Byron's arm. "Nonsense! Commence firing!"
"Hey, a Navy wife," said Lieutenant Astor.
Desogoy, trying alertly to follow this chatter, asked Thurston to translate. He burst out laughing, took Natalie's hand, and kissed it.
"Come," he said in English, "a little luncheon."
The lunch was long and excellent, in a restaurant with a lordly view, much like a San Francisco panorama, of the Lisbon Hills and the broad, sparkling river. The Commodore seemed in no hurry at all. Thurston kept checking his watch, knowing that most government offices would shut by 4:30 or 5. At 3, Desogoy said casually that perhaps they might see now how the little business was coming along. In an enormous black Mercedes limousine, they commenced a whirling tour of office buildings. Thurston tried to explain what was happening, but after a while he gave up, because he wasn't sure. Sometimes the Commodore descended for a few minutes by himself, sometimes he took the couple along to sign a ledger or a document, with Thurston accompanying them. An official invariably waited at the door to greet them and to lead them past crowded anterooms into dusty old inner offices, where fat, pallid old department heads got awkwardly out of their chairs to bow to Desogoy. About 2 hours later, they arrived at an office familiar to Thurston, where civil marriages were registered. It was closed for the day, and the blinds were drawn. As the black limousine came to a stop, one blind went up and the door opened. A huge old woman in a brown smock, with visible chin whiskers, led them through dark, empty rooms to an inner office where a chandelier blazed. At an ancient desk, fussing with papers, sat a dark, frog-faced man with gold-rimmed glasses, several gold teeth, and three thick gold rings. He smiled at them and spoke to Thurston in Portuguese. Thurston translated his questions. The man scratched with a blotchy pen on many of Byron's documents and kept stamping them. Natalie, Byron, and the two witnesses, Astor and Sloat, signed and signed. After a while, the man stood, and with a lewd, gold-flecked smile, held out his hand to Natalie, and then to Byron, saying brokenly, "Good luck for you."
"What's this now?" Natalie said.
"Why, you're married," Thurston said. "Congratulations."
"We are? Already? When did we get married? I missed it."
"At one point there where you both signed the green book. That was it."
"I haven't the faintest recollection."
Byron said, "Nor have I. However, I'll take your word for it. Let's have that ring, lady." Astor put it in his hand. He slipped the yellow band on Natalie's finger, swept her into his arms, and kissed her. Meantime, Thurston told Desogoy how the couple had missed the moment of marriage, and the Portuguese officer laughed. He laughed again when Thurston explained the American custom of kissing the bride. Natalie said that Desogoy must kiss her first. With marked pleasure, the old aristocrat executed the privilege on her lips. Then he left, after courtly handshakes all around, as Byron gathered up his sheaf of documents and paid the fees. Sloat was the last to kiss her. Natalie hesitated, looking into his eyes, and said, "Well, old Sloat, I seem to have done it, don't I? Wish me well."
"Oh, I do, Jastro, you know that."
She gave him a cool, brief kiss on the mouth, putting her free hand on his neck. When they emerged into the late golden sunshine, the black limousine was gone. The office door closed behind them, and Sloat felt something loose and grainy thrust in his hand. It was rice. Lieutenant Astor grinned a strange, cold, thin-lipped grin at him and winked a sharp blue eye. At a signal from Astor, the three men pelted the couple. Natalie, brushing rice from her dress, wiped her eyes with a knuckle.
"Well, that certainly makes it official. Now what happens?"
"If you don't know," said Lady Astor, "Byron's got a lot of fast explaining to do." Natalie choked and turned brick red.
"My God, Briny, who is this character?"
"Lady's spent too much time submerged," said Byron. "He has trouble raising his mind to sea level."
"Marriage is holy and beautiful," said Lady Astor. "But before you hop to it, how about visiting the old S-45 for a minute? The skipper's sort of expecting us."
of course," Natalie said hurriedly. "I want to see the S-45. I'm dying to, by all means."
"Have you any idea where you'll go after that?" Leslie Sloat dryly put in.
Byron said, "Well, I figured there'd be a place, a hotel, something."
"Lisbon's jammed to bursting," said Sloat.
"My God, so it is. I never gave it a thought," Natalie said.
"Why not take my place?" said Leslie Sloat. "That's a honeymoon suite if ever